KBOO is a proud sponsor with Runaway Productions of Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4, February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, 1507 Southeast 39th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Bad Habitat, Tope, Speaker Minds, Mike Crenshaw, Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4. Starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Veterans Voice. Hosts Angie and Marvin interview Jeremy Lucier and Mike Walgrave about their transition from being in the military to being farmers. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints Today welcomes a researcher who won the release of decades-old Defense Department report detailing the U.S. government's help to Israel's development of a nuclear bomb. And the parents of Rachel Corrie speak out against the decision of the Israeli Supreme Court exempting the Israeli Defense Ministry from liability for actions by its forces. At 11 o'clock, Paul Rowland speaks with author and activist Gerrymander. At 11:30, we hear the organizers of next week's panel discussion of occupation, environmental destruction, and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And once again, we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you missed our membership drive and you're not a current member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking right where it says Donate Today on the website. Thanks a lot for doing that. We're going to get right to Veterans Voice.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 104.3 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or streaming on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. Or you can hear some of our older shows that we've done by going to kboo.fm/veteransvoice, one word. I'm Marvin, and with Angie today.
Good morning, Cascadia.
And our guests today are Michael Walgrave and Jeremy Lucier. And I just want to say hi to my wife. She's up in OHSU, pretty sick, but... she's going to be okay. And we're going to be talking to the guys here in just a minute. And I want to do one more thing here before we get going. And just want to say hi to Laurel and get well soon, honey. And I'm going to hand it over to Angie to get this started.
So, Marvin, what do you think about the JTTF?
Yeah. Like we were talking, and I never heard anything about it on the news at all. Nothing. Or after either. So it's just sorry.
Well, I noticed that there was basically a media blackout on that. I was doing all kinds of searches and everything, and I could barely find anything on that. Interesting.
Very. Because they don't want us to know about it. That's one thing. So, but today we're going to be talking to these guys, and it's really interesting. And we had, what was his name on that, about the gardens last time? That was
Destan.
Yeah, Destan, man, that was really good. And so these guys will be talking a lot about stuff like that. So,
we have Jeremy and we have Mike here today. Jeremy is an Air Force veteran, and Mike is an Army veteran. And so I'd like to just maybe start with, I suppose I'll start with you, Jeremy. I'd like to ask how you got interested in joining the military in the first place. I see that you joined in 1990, actually.
Wow.
So how did you come about joining the Air Force?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on here. Marvin, God bless to your wife, and yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. How I got into the Air Force, you know, I turned 18 in March 9th of 1990 and really wasn't going anywhere in life. So basically my parents said, you're 18 now, it's time for you to leave the nest. And I was just like, what? You know, I had no clue of, you know, how to pay rent, how to pay bills. So, you know, there was a couple reasons why I joined. That was one of the reasons. You know, I was going to get paid. I was going to learn a trade. But also, you know, I come from a long line of, you know, family that has served. My father was in the Air Force as well. I had an uncle in the Air Force. You know, my grandfather served in World War II. So for me, it was, you know, something very traditional that I really needed to do.
And you were in for 14 years.
I did. I served about 14 years. You know, my experience was a little bit different. I started in the Air National Guard. Mm-hmm. Basically, I picked avionics. I qualified. It was very difficult, but I really excelled at it. So I did learn a trade. You know, I went to a lot of advanced schools. Even though I was in before Desert Storm, I didn't have to deploy. I was still in school. And a lot of things that I did were, you know, a lot of humanitarian missions.
Wow.
And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize is that's also a big portion of what the military does as
right.
well. And that's something that makes me really proud mm-hmm. while I served.
Yeah. So what exactly was your job? Avionics. I don't know. Do you know what that? I don't.
Avionics Craftsman, 105th Air Wing, Stewart.
Yep, 105th Air Wing, Stewart Air National Guard Base, which is down in Newburgh, New York. My uncle was stationed there as well.
Wow.
So that really encouraged me to join there, and we served together. Basically, I worked on the C-5 is the largest in the fleet.
Yeah.
And avionics is basically just aviation electronics.
Oh, electronics.
So gotcha. I was responsible for your GPS systems, navigation systems, mm-hmm. Autopilot, you know, any of your hardcore electronics we actually worked on. So we worked all over the aircraft, you know, where it had been hydraulics, air pressure, engines.
Wow.
So I learned a lot, and I was able to take that to, you know, outside work as well.
Mm-hmm. So did when you got out of the Air Force, did you go to work doing the same thing?
No, I got a medical discharge because I had I was diagnosed with COPD, which is chronic obstruction pulmonary disease.
Oh, wow.
So my doctor said, hey, you know, mm-hmm. you really can't do this type of work. You know, obviously, you know, JP-8 fuel and you know, sucking in all those fumes is not going to be, you know, productive for. So what I did do was as soon as I got out, you know, I had a game plan. It was like, you know, I wanted to go to school. you know, how can I supplement what I had already learned? Mm-hmm. And I decided on electrical engineering.
Ah, cool.
So you weren't actually planning on getting out of the military. You were probably planning on retiring. Is that right?
I did. You know, spending 14 years and so, having my uncle that spent 34 years in the Air Force and wow. retired. So for me, that was, you know, I was a lifer. And I was devastated at the time.
Yeah,
you know?
I can imagine.
Getting out in 2004, you know, a couple of years after 9/11, it was
right. That's right when we were starting to get into everything. Actually, when we were starting to sink into the war in Iraq and everything like that was about 2004.
Yeah. Right. You know, my whole base deployed, and you know, there's this. You know, one of the biggest things I really miss is the camaraderie. And it doesn't matter if you serve in the Army, Navy, Coast mm-hmm. Guard, Air sure. Force, whatever. You know, you all have that camaraderie. Yeah. Oh, you got the Air Force and, you know, they just yeah. sit around and do nothing. And, you know, we definitely kind of egg each other on. But, you know, that's part of, you know, that community.
Sure.
But, you know, after being out for so many years, it kind of like, okay, what's our purpose for being over there? How do, you know, us as a people in the United States or Afghanistan or Iraqi people, how are they really benefiting from what's going on over there? And, you know, it's a shame of, you know, the things that are actually happening over there.
Yeah.
So you're actually, you ended up getting out in 2004, and then where did you go after that?
Basically, just literally the day I left, I went home, I packed my car, and I just spent a month on the road, just wow. traveling around the United States,
yeah,
national
you.
Parks, visiting friends and family. And
that's something I noticed about you as well, Mike, is that you did a little bit of drifting around after you got out. So when did you join the military, and from where, and how did that come about?
Actually, I was drifting around before the military. I had a philosophy.
You just continued it when you got out.
Exactly. So I became a professional drifter when I joined the Army in 2006. And so I got out in 2009 and decided to continue traveling the U.S. One of the reasons I had traveled earlier on was I kind of felt like I needed to utilize my freedom in America that people had fought for. So not having borders in this country and an open road really appealed to me. And so I hit the trail after college the first round and went about my business for 4 to 6 years and then decided to join the military after that. I guess I may have had a little born on the 4th of July syndrome. I was born on Veterans Day, so... And so every birthday, I never got a birthday card, and unfortunately, because post office is closed on Veterans Day. And, but that I think that hit home a little bit more than, I mean, it resonated with me what was going on a little bit at an earlier age.
And so you also had family in the military, too.
I did.
Still do.
Great-grandpa served in World War I. Grandpa served in World War II. Dad served in Vietnam, and then I joined up in OEF. So,
did you think that you were going to be deployed?
I was pretty sure on that. I mean, it was 2006, and I guess I kind of felt like if I was going to be part of the military-industrial complex, I might as well be on the front lines.
In the thick of it.
In the thick of it, you know, they have a shot at me just as much as I have at them, mm-hmm. you know, and...
What did you do exactly?
I was in the infantry. I was a 11 Charlie, a mortarman.
Mortarman.
And not quite like Vietnam where you had to go through tunnels hashing people out in your spare time. But mm-hmm. We basically got out in Afghanistan, was there for 15 months. And I'd like to think we were peacekeepers while we were there. Mm-hmm. We were building schools, handing out supplies, trying to figure out all these tribal warfares that were going on village to village even. And I guess we were hunting for Osama bin Laden. At least that was
one
thing.
You never really know what
you never
doing.
Know.
I learned that too. This really interests me. Filmed Afghan highway in Paktika province, Afghanistan, to pass the time.
Yeah.
What is that about?
Well, I decided to turn the camera on while I was there, so I filmed the whole deployment just from, like, what we do in our spare time when we're not out, you know, rounding people up and what have you. So, yeah, it was more for my buddies, and it's turned out to be a pretty good project. I called it Afghan Highway because there was no actual roads where we're at, and so it was just this... You know, and not really there, but we were there, and so I took a video and got 15 months, and
wow,
yeah, we ended up sharing it over the internet.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. It's on. So, what do you, to find it on you on YouTube?
Yep.
Where do you go? What do you put in? Highway.
Afghan Highway is the name of the series. Peripheral Drifter is the name of the YouTube site. I also have a website, drifterradio.com. More or less developed from sharing with my buddies while we were over there, because we had internet access at various points. So I'd send them stuff that we were doing at our base, and they'd send me pictures from where they were at their base. And now, as it's turned out, it's kind of kept their group together a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So. That's pretty interesting.
That's really interesting.
So you were over there for how long?
15 months.
15 months? In a grunt unit.
Yeah, I don't recommend it.
Well, I'm with you. I don't recommend that at all.
So how would you describe Afghanistan?
Yeah, really.
Where we were at, it's not all of Afghanistan's like that, but where we were at, it was just a desert mountain wasteland. So you do 8 hours of guard duty a day just staring at dried up riverbeds. You know, They've definitely had some climate issues. We took over an old British fort that has been there for, I don't know, decades. And basically there used to be a farm there, but now there is nothing. And I think that's kind of played into some of the craziness they've accepted over there.
Yeah. So. Hmm. Well, and another thing I like here is Drifted for Peace, 14-week, shack boat Mississippi River drift from Wisconsin to New Orleans. Okay, come on. What is that?
All right, that was taking drifting to another level. I followed this guy in his web blog back in 2004, 2003, and told him when he got to La Crosse, Wisconsin, that he'd have a place to stay and, you know, basically open the doors for him. And when he got there, he had been off on a different life tangent, got married, and so he had this shack boat that he needed to get rid of. And so I parked it in a yacht yard for about 4 years. And when I got out of the military in 2009, about 2 months later, we painted up a big peace sign, put it up on the side of this raft, and me and a couple of buddies went down the river. So.
Oh, that's amazing, man. That's cool. That is cool. Wow.
So you were mentioning to me something about the Afghanistan people at first thought you were the Russians?
Yeah, probably the furthest that we'll ever be able to get off the map was someplace in, well, it was Winter Stand is what they called it in 2008. And we flew in there in Black Hawk helicopters, got out, and next day we started talking with the tribal leaders, and they thought we were the Russians. They couldn't believe America was this far on the other side of the country and their little neck of the woods.
That is amazing.
So, why did you get out?
It's the military, you know, and yeah. I felt like I had served my time, but I had better things to do, such as, for example, float the river and drift for peace, you know,
That's great. That is great. Were you a platoon leader?
I wasn't.
You had a college degree and you weren't a platoon leader.
I went in as an E4 and basically just wanted to see what it was like at the very bottom rung of the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. Okay, now let's talk about, Jeremy, let's talk about what you do now.
Yeah, sure. I actually just got a part-time job working at a really small bakery. It's called Farmhouse Bakery in Cottage Grove. Mm-hmm. It's family-owned by Bob and Pat Daniels. I enjoy working there. It's great. I'm learning a lot of stuff. But the other portion is, Mike and I live together down there for a couple months trying to get together you know, both Drifter Radio, doing video media. I'm also a photographer, so I'm working on a food blog. But also, we created the Veterans Victory Gardens.
Yeah, that's go ahead.
So do you want to explain that, what you were doing with that?
Sure. So I've been farming for probably since 2007. You know, I met a couple that they were basically farming. They started with, like, you know, your vegetables. They had some fruit trees. Then they graduated to raising chickens.
And you actually taught me how to humanely harvest, as they call it, a chicken and a rabbit.
Yep, we've we started harvesting rabbits, and I think the great thing that happened there was, you know, we got the system down to where, you know, you had a broody chicken that would hatch the eggs on their own, opposed to actually buying pullets or having them in an incubator and stuff. Rabbits, you know how rabbits are, so they breed pretty quick. But yeah, we hosted a class. We had a lot of veterans come out, and you know, one of the things is, you know, you're taking a life. I'm a Buddhist, so, you know, for me, I would do a lot of meditation before I would actually do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you would do it at night or early in the morning where it was dark, you know, where they're still kind of sleepy. Hang them upside down and let them rest. But mm-hmm. you would sit there and you would, you know, just coax them and just, you know, basically talk to the animal and say, you know, thank you for providing us sustenance, and you know, just to make sure it was really calm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as we gained more experience, we learned better ways to actually slaughter that animal. I like to say harvest, because some people kind of get a little detracted from that word, but mm-hmm. yeah, it was amazing.
Wow. And so why do you gravitate towards farming so much, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. You know, one thing I want to bring up is this book called Field Exercises by Stephanie Westland. And basically it just talks about how veterans, when they're transitioning from that military environment to a civilian one, you know, there's a lot of discord, and it can be very difficult. So, you know, veterans are getting involved in a farming where you have a tangible goal. You can see the results, whether it be, you know, you're growing beans, you know, week by week, or even 3 days along the way. You're seeing that plant grow. It flowers. You see that fruit growing. There's a lot of satisfaction there. So when you get to see, you know, how you go from, you know, putting a bean into the ground to where you're picking those beans, basically farm to plate, you're cooking your meal.
Right.
It's an amazing experience, and it's very... you know, especially with people that have PTSD, which I was diagnosed with, it really helps. You know, you know, a lot of times it's just like, it's not the 9-to-5 job where, you know, you're basically just a drone and, you know, you're paying taxes, and, you know, this is something that you can actually readily enjoy. You can teach other people. And if you talk to a lot of other vets, it's really beneficial. You know, another one is you can do photography, equestrian, you know, mm-hmm. whitewater kayaking. It's like, you know, whatever takes you out of your element, and, you know, rather than you're stuck in your head, it's kind of, you have something else to think about and, you know, other goals that you can achieve.
Right. And I think that just being in nature in general is one of those things that's really therapeutic for vets. Is, for me, one of the things I did when I got out is I spent a lot of time out in the woods. I would just drive out and park and hike into the woods and just stay out there for a few days and separate myself. And I think that one of the main things is that the plants and the animals don't judge you, and you don't feel under pressure like you do when you're going through the grind and everything like that. So... I think a lot of vets can identify with that. Mm-hmm. So, do you know of any resources or anything for veterans if they want to get involved in farming or sustainability, or any types of suggestions you can give to people if they're interested in getting involved with that?
Oh, absolutely. One of the bigger ones I'd like to bring up is Farmer Veteran Coalition. What was it? Farmer Veteran Coalition. And basically that organization just helps veteran farmers set up farms. Sometimes they all have a grant that you can get to help set up your farm. One of the things that I got to participate in was it was all paid for retreat up at Vashon Island, which if you haven't been up there, it's amazing. It's beautiful. You know, they pay for our food. We had a place to stay. You know, we sat around in a circle, you know, all different kind of veterans. You know, one couple brought their whole family up. So there's, you know, children there as well, you know, because when you really look at it, you know, just because, you know, a husband or a wife serve, you know, the family serves, you know, when the veteran suffers, the whole family suffers.
Oh yeah.
And, it was an amazing experience. It was a difficult time. You know, I was worried about, you know, I didn't have a job and am I going to be able to pay my rent? Am I going to be able to eat? You know, am I going to end up on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like this really, it's a teeter totter, you know, it can go either
fine
way.
Line.
Yeah, really fine line.
Mm-hmm. There's also the Returning Veteran Project.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a really great resource for people.
They're,
absolutely.
Yeah,
and
they're wonderful.
Homegrown by Heroes, too, is, I believe, if you have like a certain product that you want to sell under the Homegrown by Heroes name, if you have two veterans that contribute crops to that specific product that you want to sell, then you can put the Homegrown by Heroes label on it. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting that you did almost a complete 180 from you were in aviation electronics and you were pretty much not planning to get out by any means. And then all of a sudden, here you are at KBU Radio talking about how you are doing sustainable farming. That's really different.
It's veteran.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So who got you interested in, how'd you get involved in that?
Well, actually, you know, when I visited Oregon for the first time, it was...
Okay, where are you from? I forgot.
I'm originally from New York. I grew up in the capital, and then I was stationed about 60 miles north of the actual city.
Yeah.
You know, I met this gentleman from just kayaking.
Hmm.
You know, that was one of my biggest passions. I would actually go to Canada twice a year. I'd go up there and train and do freestyle kayaking, like surfing, things like that. It's kind of like skateboarding on water, basically.
wow.
And we were two totally opposite people. You know, here I was. I just got out. I was still pretty gung-ho. You know, and it definitely took a while for that transition to really happen. But, you know, our relationship just kind of grew from there.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got more involved in each other's lives. And, you know, it just happened. And I think it was, you know, a word I like to use is symbiotic. And
I
think that's something that we've lost is we don't have this symbiotic relationship with nature that we should have. And, you know, when you think about, you know, Victory Gardens back in World War II, you know, every house, you know, have two chickens and grow your own crops. And, you know, it was more sustainable back there. And, you know, now it's like, you know, you're shipping your food in on these big trucks or on a rail car or, and I think we really need to get back, you know, in terms of like food security and securing your community is having a smaller base where, okay, well, if I'm growing potatoes or raising chickens and you have tomatoes or some other crop that, you know, you can either barter or do a direct trade, you know, where it's, you have this internal monetary system that you're not relying on the actual dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can end homelessness, you can end, you know, people living in poverty, not being able to eat.
Right.
You know, because we're basically a fast food nation.
Oh,
and we need to get back to, you know, what we really need to be.
Right.
Yeah. So do you down in Cottage Grove, do you trade a lot of your products to other people?
Well, I actually live in an apartment now, so I've only been there for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few farms out there that are looking for internships or, you know, you have a work trade, rent trade type of a deal. So that's something I definitely want to look into is more of, you know, homestead living where, you know, you're working as a community. You know, I'm a photographer, so I can take pictures of the crops and, you know, put that out there, while if somebody knows how to sew, you know, we can trade off those skills and, you know, build this, you know, more of kind of like a spider web network of relationships where, you know, you're all kind of like, it's held together.
Mm-hmm. And it seems really hard to get out of, too. It seems really hard to break free from any kind of what we would consider as normal routine life. Once you want to actually start digging in the dirt and raising the animals and doing things like that, if you live in the city, it can be kind of tough, especially when you have to work so much harder than, like, for example, my parents live out in Eastern Oregon, out by John Day, and I could live out there for $300 a month in a house, or I could live here for a $1,000 apartment, and then I work 10 times harder trying to pay for that than I would out there. So it's really, you have to work so much harder just to break free from that kind of thing out here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what are you getting for your dollar? I mean, you're spending $1,000 on an apartment for
nothing.
For what?
It's a place to lay your head.
Right.
Okay, now, Michael, let's get to you about how you got involved in farmers.
Well, it kind of stems from the doing the guard duty and looking at nothingness for 15 months, you know. It's kind of where I see our world going towards. And so kind of a personal responsibility. I see local agriculture as a big solution to what we're facing right now. And so after I went down the river, I, you know, drifting for peace, I was trying to figure out what the next piece of the puzzle would be to get there. And agriculture came up. So my grandpas were farmers. And so I decided to go back to school at the University of Wisconsin in River Falls and got my agribusiness degree. And yeah, now I'm just trying to lay my roots down and get involved. And I met Jeremy through the Boots to Roots program, which I highly recommend any veterans returning, that if you're having issues and problems, it's best to get involved with other veterans, because they might be able to, Jeremy's helped me verbalize a lot of things I've been thinking and going through, and as well as other veterans that I've worked with. And from there, I've gone back to school for the university online system for sustainable management, and now I'm just trying to get involved with local agriculture.
Yeah,
that's great. Go ahead.
So what exactly, when you say studying agriculture, what are you trying to, what do you think you would like to focus on?
Well, I'm interested kind of in the hemp coming down the chute here.
Yeah.
It's a couple of years out, but once recreational marijuana has its time and place, we'll probably move into the hemp industry. And I see that as a great base for these transition towns that are popping up. Mm-hmm. We're trying to transition to a more sustainable, locally focused community. And the hemp plant, to me, is a big solution. I've done various papers on that in school, and you can make 5,000 products out of that thing, at least, you know, including the basic necessities of living, such as food, clothing, rope, paper, you know, hempcrete, building supplies. So that's something I'm looking at. But I definitely like the idea of community building instead of so everybody just trying to capitalize for their own gain and their own independent mean. And kind of like the idea of the interdependence. So that's going to definitely be key to moving past war, I believe. So.
Well, talk about, you know, I want to know about Boots to Roots. I've never heard of that one.
It was a program, what was it, 2012, summer 2012. It's in the book that Jeremy was talking about, too. Steve Cran came over from Australia and taught a two-week permaculture class.
Wow.
And
that was the one that Destan was part of.
Oh, Marvin. Yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. As well as Penny.
Penny,
they were,
too.
They were
right.
All, and
yeah,
Ian.
I remember.
Everybody
yeah.
was involved in that.
Were you?
I wasn't there at the time. I don't know what I was doing. I think I was working every day, working my life away.
Yeah.
To pay for the vegetables with money that I could have got from you guys for
yeah.
free. And I don't know how that works exactly.
Yeah, it didn't work out well. So when you lived on a farm?
I haven't grown up on a farm. I moved out here in 2012, so actually that's how I started meeting people out here in Portland, was through the Boots to Roots program. One of my Army buddies invited me to move out to Portland, and since this has been considered one of the most sustainable cities in America, it made sense. And yeah, got involved, and I was starting to build, I guess.
Wow, that's interesting.
Wow. What do you think was one of the most important things that you learned about the Boots to Roots?
You can do it. I mean, it's not outside the average person's capabilities to build something like that. You just have to stay vigilant with it. But just the community, I think, and the healing process. Like I said, after work, we'd sit around and talk about our experiences, and some people had had more problems than others, but you're able to hash it out, and I don't know, that sense of community was definitely medicinal in that sense.
Why do you think that some veterans are more likely to reach out to other veterans and some aren't?
It's hard to say.
Do you think that some people kind of barricade themselves away?
I think they don't really want to deal with anybody or anything. The system feels broken, and they might not be able to articulate that. And once you're out of the military, you just kind of want to be away from the military. You know, there's trust factors. You know,
Marvin, do you know what that feels like?
Oh yeah, yeah. So that's really interesting that you talk about that. When you were in, was there any Jeremy? Was there any dissension in the Air Force where you were about the wars and the war?
I mean, we definitely had our own controversies. You know, pretty much you keep your opinion tight-lipped. You know, when they were looking for people to actually volunteer to deploy, nobody wanted to volunteer.
Oh, really?
You know, so, I mean, just like any other community, you had mixed feelings. Another huge controversy was the anthrax vaccination, where people didn't want to get it. You know, they're going to quit, or, you know, go AWOL, or however you want to put it. You know, I mean, like I said, you know, being where I was at, the majority of, you know, my deployments are humanitarian. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that took on a completely different element than actually deploying and
to a war zone.
Right. And the fact of being stationed in New York during 9/11, that took on a completely different meaning.
What was that like?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
I probably cried for 2 weeks.
Really?
Do you know anybody that passed?
I did. We lost two members of our unit.
Oh.
They were in their primary jobs. One was an EMT, the other one was a New York police officer. And, you know, Andrew Dunn and Jerome, Mark Patrick Dominguez went in to save people. So for me, they're heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, unfortunately, they died. And it has a profound effect on me. And even though I didn't feel it at first, it, you know, it definitely took a couple of years before, you know, I really started feeling the effects of anxiety and PTSD. And it wasn't like, boom, it's there. It just slowly creeped into my life. And, mm-hmm. you know, slowly it was like, okay, loud noises or, mm-hmm. you know, fireworks or things like that, that, you know, really affect me. You know, I jump and get the jitters, having a hard time sleeping, you know, not being able to go to parades or concerts or, you know, movies, you know, being around large crowds of people, mm-hmm. you know, would make you feel uncomfortable. You know, you're checking everybody out. You sit in a, you know, specific place, you know, so you can watch the door. But it's, you know, it's a two-way street, you know, when, you know, I recognize some of my triggers, you know, like caffeine. I don't drink caffeine. It's very rare because that just makes it worse. I try not to put myself in those situations, but at the same time, you know, you've got to test those borders. You have to put yourself, you know, outside that box, just uh-huh. because you know, like you're saying, it's, you know, you get the veterans that, and I've been there where you're shelled up in your house, you don't go out anywhere, you don't talk to people, you know, some people play video games like Call of Duty, uh-huh. so they're still putting that same, memory from being in the war, basically regurgitating it.
Over and over, yeah.
And, you know, I tend not to, you know, I don't play those type of games. You know, I do a lot of meditation.
Maybe that's why you got so involved with farming and working with nature and plants and things like that, is because of it's relaxing.
It's a really big deal to me. Like I said, I'm a Buddhist, so, you know, I really look towards nature for inspiration. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can just be out there and just be. You know, you listen to the water, you know, bubbling in the creek, or, you know, you hear the birds chirping, or squirrels, or, you know, just the fresh air and, you know, the fresh earth is very healing. And, you know, I'm just glad I'm able to enjoy it. You know, typically if I go hiking with people, it's, you know, I have my camera and I really take my time and really take it in. And, you know, I usually don't talk just because I really want to take it all in. And, you know, if you're patient, you know, I think, you know, if you're patient and you really appreciate it, nature rewards you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen some amazing things where it's like, you know, some people might look at it as a coincidence or, oh, that's great. You know, but for me, it's like, okay, what can I learn from this? Mm-hmm. And that's why I love it and really put myself out there.
Yeah, your Buddhism helps you with that a lot.
Absolutely.
Buddhism is kind of saved me too, you know, just mm-hmm. the things that it taught us to how to survive. So it's a good thing. More people should check out Buddhism.
Absolutely. Or Hinduism, you. Or Taoism. Yeah. You know, all those things. Take the pieces that work for you and grow from that.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. there's all kinds of different things from each one of those that you can take to yourself. And very helpful. Very helpful.
Right. I got a question for Mike.
Yeah, Mike.
I got a question for you.
Mike, you're on the hot seat.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm curious about your experience with Team Rubicon down there with the hurricane relief. I haven't really asked you about that at all. So, explain what Team Rubicon is.
Okay, Team Rubicon was started by a Marine, so it's an exclusively veterans disaster mediation organization, nonprofit. I believe David Petraeus is on the board at this point. I went to Superstorm Sandy. After we got done with Boots to Roots, I was just volunteering around Portland, and my buddy recommended I fill out a form and sign up for Team Rubicon. And so I did, and within 24 hours, I ended up in New Jersey. So, and we were cleaning up after Superstorm Sandy, and that was pretty cool. And we found that veterans have definitely a get her done attitude.
Right. Exactly.
We're going to figure it out. We're not going to get stalled by little things. We're going to just dig right in.
Your boots get a little muddy or something.
You just keep on going.
Yeah, it might not be the most beautiful process, but mm-hmm. you're going to get it done. And so I found that was a great organization. So if you're a veteran looking to volunteer, I'd definitely check that out. And
how do you find out about it? Do you Google it?
Oh, yeah. Just put in Team Rubicon. Their website is teamrubiconusa.org.
So do they actually fly you out, or how do you get to the site?
We took a crew from Portland and drove up to Washington and flew out there. So
you drove.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They have it divided. They've divided the country into 10 different segments, I believe. So
do they pay for your food or anything like that?
Yep, they took care of the food and the housing and the flight. So there was no paycheck. There are paid positions, but there, I believe they are hiring right now. So that might be something people want to look into. We were shacked up with the Red Cross Association group that was out there, and we found that they're a little bit older organizations, so they were more doing with the paperwork and handling the stuff. But when it came to like clearing trees and tearing down stuff and pulling out the heavy equipment, that's kind of where we came into it.
And that was in Sandy.
That was Superstorm Sandy.
Superstorm Sandy.
Yep, in New Jersey, 2000.
Wow. See, a lot of people don't understand that when people go into these humanitarian, like Jeremy did, that can be traumatic. I mean, really traumatic. Terry Brown was a Marine, and he talks about you know, doing humanitarian stuff in floods and different things like that. And he, you know, dealt with bodies and all that. Mm. He came out of the first Iraq war. You know, the war in Iraq is just a continual thing. There's no first or, you know, it's all one big war that they started. But Terry had been in 91, I think Terry was. And then after they took him to, I think, Pakistan or somewhere where there'd been a earthquake and stuff. And they went right from a killing zone right to a dead zone,
wow.
You know. And he had a hard time. So, you know, when people say humanitarian, it's not passing out candy bars and doing things like that. It's important.
I did a humanitarian mission with my ship in South Korea, actually. There was a hurricane there, and we went there and just bucketed just gallons of mud out of people's houses for several days. I mean, all their houses were just filled with mud. And I think, like, why aren't we doing more of that? Because that was sure helpful, and the people were sure happy to have us there helping clear out their houses of mud and things like that. But why do we have to pay $8.5 million for a Reaper drone if we can just go help people in need? I don't understand. I don't make the connection there.
Especially so. Michael with being in infantry, because I was, and my whole outlook on people coming back really was different. You know, I my whole thinking about how things were done turned really different. And that's, I think that's why I went towards the helping people, you know, to get away from what we did. And it was more peaceful and more settling for me.
Yeah.
Than, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, after you're mixed up in the chaos, it's kind of nice to be able to, you know, put the gun down and just help sort through other people's messes, I suppose, and just try to give in a different way. And
What was your experience like with the Afghan people?
Yeah, how did you deal with the Afghans?
It was difficult, like I mentioned earlier. There was intertribals going on, warfare, basically, so... Mostly they seemed to be happy that we were there. We were definitely trying to build schools, but at the same time, if we weren't protecting the schools, we had to guard one particular place just because they burned the school down right after we built it. And so, I don't know. They appreciated the food that we were bringing in, the clothing and such, but at the same time, they weren't quite trusting of us, probably.
I wonder why.
Here's our guns if you don't like what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, here's
Do you think
other.
That we added to their intertribal warfare at all?
Perhaps.
I think so?
I can't really comment on that. I would imagine that they tried to play us between the other villages at certain points. And, you know, they're definitely hashing out a lot of different lies in their own style of, psyops, I guess.
Yeah. Was there a lot of kids in your area?
There were a lot of kids, mostly, you know, and multiple wives and multiple kids. And since you know the death rate is higher there for children, it was just part of the whole culture to have more children. Just to
because that's with us in Vietnam. You know, to me, seeing all those children and the war being around them, and you know things happening to these children was just devastating for me. Just devastating. And you had this feeling of, I can't help that poor kid, you know?
Right.
You know, you want to help these kids, and you can't. So there's just that feeling, you know?
Yeah.
Feeling, and it's just a horrible, horrible feeling that you just can't, you want to help them, but you can't, you know? So did the guys in your unit, were there a lot of thinking about, I support this war, I don't support the war? Or nobody talked?
Yeah, a lot of it, they were just, you know, a lot of people joined up because they were coming from impoverished situations. So, one of the things I interviewed people on with Afghan Highway is, why did you join the military? at least 9 times out of 10, it was money.
Money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think, and Afghan Highway, tell them how they can see, because I'm going to go there and I'm going to watch that, man.
All right. It's tell kinda, them how to do it's it. It's kind of infantry humor, so maybe you'll like it, Marvin. I don't know if your audience might appreciate it, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Peripheral Drifter, if you search under YouTube, that should bring it up, or drifterradio.com.
Okay, Drifter Radio. What's that? Drifter, tell about that.
Well, in 2004, after I'd been hitchhiking around the United States and seeing this planet and, or seeing the country and going to foosball tournaments. Yeah, I said foosball.
To what tournaments?
Foosball.
Foosball tournaments.
That was my American dream. I like the game, you know. It doesn't matter that the top player in the world makes $5,000, you know.
High goals, high goals.
No pressure there. Remember how much pressure we felt when in an infantry unit? How much pressure there was on you?
Yeah.
And then coming out of that, it's just like, it's horrible.
I think I do drink coffee. Jeremy mentioned that it gives him anxiety, and I think I almost drink coffee just to supplement my anxiety, you know? There's not some sort of pressure situation going on. It's almost like I don't know how to just be peaceful sometimes.
Yeah. You know? It's hard. It's really hard. Do you go to the VA?
I did. I just started going there, and I recommend that to every veteran out there.
Me too.
Sooner than later, because, you know, I don't know if you guys have been downtown here or not, but that was a maze just to get in there, you know, and I didn't realize I was having to go through security checks and all this craziness. And,
yeah.
And I thought about it, and I'm like, I have half my wits about me still, and if I only had a quarter of them, I don't know if I would have been able to make it there.
Right.
You know? So definitely get there earlier and get your paperwork started.
Yeah, you got to get that paperwork going in and taking care of that, because a lot of do you go to the VA, Jeremy?
I'm actually very fortunate that you know, I was also a military contractor, and a condition of my employment, I had to be in the military. So when I was getting discharged from the military, I had a provision in my contract that said if I was medically discharged that I would be compensated. So I got 60% of my salary for the first year. I get 40% for life. Living in Portland, my insurance, they pick up the major of the premium. I pay what I normally would pay, and, you know, I would go to Kaiser. I had the same doctor for 10 years. We developed a great relationship where it wasn't that she decided or I decided what the treatment was going to be. We kind of decided and came up with a game plan that was, you know, equally mutual. You know, because, you know, you hear a lot of people that go to the VA and it's just like, you know, they just throw the pills at you, you know, here, take the blue one. Okay, well, that didn't work. Take the red one. And, you know, and, you know, a lot of people, we call them Skittles.
Yeah.
And it's terrible where, you know, my doctor, okay, you know, let's start on the medication, you know, but, you know, wean off of that.
Right.
You know, there has to be some type of therapy that coincides with that. And, you know, just to touch on what Marvin said about, you know, serving in humanitarian missions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think it was in 98. During Christmas, I had to go to Caracas, Venezuela, and it was one of their worst natural disasters. Upwards of 30,000 people died.
Wow.
That's tough.
You know, that's like you tough. Said, just bodies and bodies and yep. bodies and bodies. And
yep. You never get over that.
No, and I
never,
think the,
ever.
I think the sad part is there was no aftercare.
Right.
It wasn't like I came back and, okay, you know, sit down, talk to a therapist, are you having, you know, problems or issues. It was basically like, even when I got discharged, it was, that's it. The gates close. You're done.
About face march.
Right. And, you know, I served 14 years and,
yeah, and
you
then,
know, that really bothered me.
Yeah. I can imagine.
And that probably affected how you could find employment too. And how you socialize with people and everything else. Right.
I took the first year off.
See, that's really smart.
Yeah.
You know,
that's smart. What you guys did was smart.
And
taking that time off, boy.
But I did get a job when I first came to Portland. I was a server at Romano's Macaroni Grill.
Oh, that's I used to go there.
It was great. You know, it kept me busy. You know, I quickly became a manager there. I made really good money. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time, you know, the civilian world, you know, kind of didn't have that negative connotation of veterans at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure some people did, you know, warmongers, baby yeah. killers, things like that. But it was actually an asset. You know, when I look at it now and, you know, you have all your military experience on your resume, it's different. You know, a lot of people think, oh, he's got the PTSD.
Yep.
You know, he rubs up against me, I'm going to catch it.
Well, there's so much in the media that talks about veterans are ticking time bombs, veterans are going to lash out. Yeah, go postal.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's a shame because...
It's a real shame.
You look at, you know, the infrastructure of the United States, it's crumbling.
Yes, it is.
We don't have the money to fix it, but, you know, a great way to... rebuild that to, you know, back in our World War II days is get veterans involved. They have the skill set, yeah. You know, just because I was aviation electronics, you know, I can take those, that skill set and still apply it to other things. You know, we're, you know, military people are extremely adaptable people.
That's true.
And, you know, I think if people really embrace that and give veterans a chance, just like everybody else, that you'll be very surprised at what they can achieve in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Mike was saying about the boots to roots, you know, I have before and after pictures of, you know, what we did. We transformed a 4,000 square foot garden.
Oh, that's amazing.
And, you know, at first you're like, wow, you know.
It was all blackberries before, wasn't it?
A lot of blackberries, you know, 4 foot tall weeds. And, you know, it had been growing for a while. So, it took time, but, you know, just like watching the vegetables grow, when you see this thing come together and we all work together for this common goal, and then you see the end result, I mean, it was amazing. And it was 2 weeks. And
go ahead.
It's hard to really put into words unless you really go out there and do it yourself.
Yeah.
And it's such a good idea, though, if we could use veteran skills and work ethic in order to go, like you were saying, go replace the sewers and go rebuild all the buildings and fix things around this country. You know, one thing I always wonder about is why don't we have more recycling facilities? Because we most of the stuff we recycle gets shipped off to another country on a barge ship.
Yeah.
So why don't we build more from scratch recycling facilities and make them more common? Because out where my parents live, there isn't hardly anything out there. Everything just gets thrown away, all the plastic and everything. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's the great thing about when you grow your own food. You know, you're not using plastic or, you know, there's a lot less waste compared to shopping at the grocery store.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, we just ran out of time, you guys. Jeremy, Michael.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming. It's,
yeah, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure, and there's so much more to do. And I'm just glad Angie's here helping me, you know, and doing a lot more stuff, you know. It's great. And we'll be back on March 20th at 9 a.m. This is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall.
As citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KABU is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio and Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights are proud to sponsor a panel discussion called Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. A panel discussion on international resistance this Tuesday, February 24th at the PSU Smith Center Ballroom. This panel will feature the Portland appearance of Palestinian intellectual and activist Omar Barghouti, as well as Kanahus Manuel, mother of four and First Nations anti-mining activist from British Columbia, Cecily Saraski, communications director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Dr. Michael Yellowbird, professor of sociology and anthropology and director